Hello, everyone. This is Words About Books, a poorly spoken podcast. I'm Ben. I'm here with my co-host, Nate, and we're talking about part three of The Poppy War. If you happen to miss the first two parts, please go back and check those episodes out. Nate, if you want to give a brief recap of where we were when we left off, and we'll go from there.
All right. Last time, Rin and Chagan discovered that someone dear to them has betrayed them, and they strongly suspected that the Muganese had found the secret mountain pass to the capital, which Alten later confirmed. And so they set out from the besieged city to go attempt to rescue the capital.
Okay. Good recap. Only took three takes.
Thanks.
All right. So, I'm not doing much better starting off. Part three opens up with Rin, the shaman division, floating down the river on sampans towards Golanice. They're hoping to get there before the Mugen army so that they can warn the city of the incoming raid. But pretty quickly they realize that's not how this is going to go, as the river starts to look a little odd. They think maybe the light is reflecting in a strange way, but they realize it's blood, and there's a bunch of bodies floating down the river as well, and it's like two pages in to chapter 21, it has turned into a horror movie.
This book really should have had trigger warnings or some sort of warning of what was about to come.
Yeah.
And I think you mentioned that before.
I'll just read a little excerpt. The boat stopped moving completely. They were surrounded by corpses. Soldiers, civilians, men, women, children. They were uniformly bloated and discolored. Some of their faces were disfigured, slashed apart. Others were simply blank, resigned, bobbing listless in the crimson water as if they had never been living, breathing bodies. They're actually forced out of the boats because the river is so choked with human remains that they get to the shore and they run to Golanice, still miles from the city.
Not a good start.
No. The road to Golanice is completely empty. Kara scouts ahead with her birds, but there's nothing to see. There's no enemy combatants, no sign of any guards or patrols. When they arrive at Golanice, they find the gates open and the city silent. The smell is the first thing that assaults them. She had experienced it at Sinegard and Coeur d'Alene. She knew what to expect now. It had been a fool's hope to expect anything different, but still she could not fully recognize the sight that awaited them when they passed through the barrier. Golanice was a city of corpses. The Muganese had massacred the city. Rin finds bodies in all manner and creative mode of cruelty that any human mind could possibly conceive. There are piles of corpses neatly stacked. Some piles, it looks like they attempted to burn, but when they realized it wasn't going to light, they just gave up. There's bodies hanging from hooks, people who were buried up to their necks in the dirt, and then hungry dogs set upon them. Every kind of war crime imaginable.
And it's actually much worse than you just described.
Yeah, I'm leaving a lot out, partly for the sake of brevity and partly because it's not... It's like you said, there should be a trigger warning on this book, particularly this part, and it just gets worse. There's no easy way to describe it because it is a very somber moment, and it's based of actual accounts of war crimes that took place in China. Is it Nanjing or Nanking?
I've heard it pronounced both ways, actually. I wouldn't be surprised if Nanjing is the way it is pronounced in Chinese, and Nanking is a more Anglo-sized version. Yeah, Wikipedia says Nanjing, Nan meaning south and Jing meaning capital, It's alternately romanized as Nanking or even Nankin.
But yeah, the massacre at Golanese is heavily inspired by the actual events that took place in Nanjing. It's really, the things Rin witnesses are comparable to just the worst crimes in human history. The Holocaust, the rape of Nanjing, and basically they fan out to search for survivors. And it just gets worse the further you go into the city. There's the corpses of women, children, evidence of all kinds of torture and cruelty. It cannot be overstated how horrible the things Rin witnesses are. And the book really goes into detail and makes you feel what Rin's feeling.
Yeah, she interviews, or she finds one of her classmates, a female classmate who went into medicine.
Well,
that was,
yeah,
not easy to read at all. That was tough,
yeah,
to get through.
Yeah, we talked about Rin does find some survivors eventually. Fortunately, one of the survivors is her friend Kite. He survived by hiding in a basement and bricking up the doorway so that it looked like it was just part of the building. A small squadron of people has been able to survive and make their way out to the hills. They come back when they see activity in the city, and Rin breaks down when she meets Kite. She also finds one of her friends survived as a comfort woman, which, again, has a real-life parallel. And all the other survivors they find are in a similar state of just shock. And I know one of the things we talked about earlier in the book is Rin's motivations and her patriotism. And when Rin speaks with her former classmate who survived as a comfort woman, the classmate tells Rin that the only thing she wants is for Rin to kill every last one of them. And Rin agrees. Like, at this moment, I think if Rin was on the fence at all about going all in, I think up until really this point, Rin obviously didn't want any of her countrymen to die in a war. She didn't want a Mugen invasion or anything like that, but she was mostly becoming a soldier to secure her future. It was a reliable job. It was a good source of income. Now I think she is fully committed to the cause of just annihilating the Mugen Empire. This isn't about a war between two nations or anymore. This is about revenge for Rin. Now, do you have anything more you want to say about these events before we move on to the other characters' reactions?
No, I think we covered it pretty well.
Okay. She decides to go talk to Alton. She needs to know what they're going to do about this. She finds him in the library, opium pipe in hand, deep in a stupor. Oh, the one thing maybe we should talk about, the whole thing is played out from Rin's perspective, but for Alton, this is the second time he's seen this sort of Mugen cruelty and genocide. When I was first reading it, I was sort of so shocked by the events that I didn't think much about how it would affect Alton to see this again. I was also kind of like, I had a negative opinion of Alton by this point, so I wasn't really thinking much about his feelings, but
I wasn't either.
Yeah, but, you know, going through again to summarize, what do you think this was like for Alton? I mean, I gotta imagine the only thing you could think is, like, I actually did die and go to hell. Like, maybe, maybe I didn't survive that island.
I mean, he was kind of broken before, but keeping himself somewhat together, and after this he's done. he's pretty much done from this point on. I guess he tries. Yeah, he's still got one more plan, but it's a really desperate, crazy plan that, as the reader, you can tell it's not going to work.
And I want to read just one more line from the book here. Finally, Alton looked in her direction. His face twisted into a droll, uninterested smile. And even in the ruins of Golanis, even in this city of corpses, Rin thought that the sight of Alton there was the most terrible thing she'd ever seen. So another thing I wanted to talk about a little bit, the book is called The Poppy Wars, and up until this point, the drug usage, they've had realistic depictions of what the drug usage could do, but it was always sort of, in a memory. It wasn't really given in perspective.
It was on the periphery.
Yeah. Now we've confirmed that Alton is an opium addict, which is something that was foreshadowed in the siege. What do you think about the depictions of drug use in the book?
I would say that the drug depiction in the book is realistic, but also one of the least horrible things about the many things that happen in this book, if you can believe that.
I never quite knew how I felt about the use of drugs to access the Pantheon. I know that that's a part of traditional shamanism, but it's interesting that Rin is so shocked by Alton's opium usage, considering she uses opium herself to access her powers. She doesn't smoke it, but she's certainly opium adjacent.
Opium adjacent. You've got a point there. She does have to use drugs. I'm sure all the shaman have to use drugs, except maybe Chagin. I don't think he did.
Well, they do mention that most shaman wind up addicted.
Yeah, that's why they have their own pharmacist on board who is supposed to give them specific dosages and try to prevent addiction.
I want to bring up one more point about the carnage that took place at Golanese. And when Kite debriefs Rin on what happened, she finds out a couple of things. She finds out that the Empress abandoned the city before it was sacked. She finds out that the city surrendered, and she tries to explain to herself how all of this could have happened despite the surrender. I'm going to read a quote. "The answer could not be rational. It was not founded in military strategy. It was not because of a shortage of food, rations, or because of the risk of insurgency or backlash. It was simply what happened when one race decided that the other was insignificant." So that sort of sets the tone for the conflict. I know up until this point there had been racism. Like, the Mugen obviously feel that they're superior. But I don't think the Nikarans realized that they were in a war of extinction. I mean, I guess this is just flat out genocide.
Yeah, this is straight up genocide. And it only gets worse.
So knowing that it's straight up genocide, Alton has a plan. I think everything is taking place from Rin's perspective, but these realizations that Rin's having, that they're in a war for the survival of their country, not just the survival of its government, but the survival of its people. Alton is coming up with a very reckless plan. Rin overhears a conversation between Alton and Chagin, and they're at the gates of the city. Chagin looks like he is about to leave. He's taking Kara with him. They're going to do something, and Alton isn't happy about Chagin's response to something. They have an argument, and during the argument, Chagin can't believe that Alton is suggesting this and says that what Alton is suggesting is an atrocity, to which Alton is just incredulous. How can Chagan speak of atrocities given what they're standing in? What atrocity could be greater than this? And Chagan responds, what Mugen has done is human cruelty, but humans alone are only capable of so much destruction. The beings locked inside the Chulu Korik are capable of ruin on a different scale altogether. Alton's plan is to invade the Chulu Korik and set free the shaman who have lost themselves to their gods. Alton believes that at least some of them can be brought under his control and command enough to act as weapons against the Muganese.
The reason he believes that is, who's the guy on their team who he has prones of berserk rage, and Alton's able to calm him down and get him back to a baseline human state. Alton believes that maybe that will work on some of the shaman inside this prison, which is basically a mountain that the gods cannot reach. So their power is nullified inside of this prison.
It's either in the next chapter or shortly after that, they tell the legend of a goddess who fell to earth, and the chief deity of the pantheon was not happy about that and constructed a prison where her powers wouldn't work. And so that became Chulu Korik. It's a mountain where the pantheon cannot be reached. Shaman powers do not work there. Which I guess answers one question, now that I think about it, that we had. Do the gods come from within or from without? I guess they come from without, because you can be in the Chulu Korik and I suppose that's a pretty clear answer. So I want to ask one more time. I'm sure I've already mentioned it. Why would anyone talk to the gods? I mean, they sound like devils.
Well, that's why. A lot of speaking with devils in fiction is about gaining power at a great cost.
Do you think any of the gods are good? Because the goddess who falls to earth in the legend, she does help people. She's a force for good. She teaches them a lot of stuff and helps them build a society, like what a god typically does. It's interesting to me that every single one of these people, they all worship different gods, and I get it that the gods are explained as a force of nature, and it's like, fire can be good, fire can be bad. It's how you use the fire that matters. So I can see that to a point, but the fact that the gods want to take over your body and throw the world out of balance and just do their thing, like, that's odd to me.
Well, do you think that the Phoenix would lend you his power to start a campfire? I don't think that he has... I don't know. He says that he has no agenda, but I just can't see him giving you power just for some asinine usage like that. He seems to want you to use it for the most destruction and bloodshed you can possibly get.
Yeah, and I guess you could argue that is in keeping with the nature of fire. The nature of fire is to burn as long as possible, as much as possible, until all the fuel is gone.
I wouldn't be surprised if there were some, quote, good gods, but they're not gods that we're going to see on the 13th Regiment.
Well, there is that.
Yeah, no one's going to get a god that grows flowers as their murder weapon of choice. They're going to go for the one that turns them into a bear, or shoots fireballs, or commands the wind, or the shadows, or whatever.
So Alton's plan is to go and and collect these shaman who have essentially become demigods. I'm not sure exactly when it's explained, but what Rin will come to find out is that the reason this plan is so insane, the reason these people have to remain in Chulu Korik, is they cannot be killed by any conventional means. Once the god has fully taken over a mortal, they become a demigod. Their body is basically indestructible. So if Alton can't convince them to follow his orders, there's no way back. Most of these people were imprisoned barely or just in time or tricked into going there. Do you think
that that's cheating? Yes. Yeah, I absolutely do.
No, I was going to ask, do you think Alton's plan makes sense from his perspective?
From his perspective, I think he's desperate and he's willing to do any crazy thing that he possibly can to maybe get some sort of revenge for what happened at the Capitol. From everyone else's perspective, it's pretty obvious it's not going to work, but I see him as so desperate at this point that he's willing to believe that it could work.
Why do you think he's that desperate?
Well, they mention around this time, actually, he was experimented on in a lab, and then he witnessed the death of Spear, or I guess he witnessed the death of Spear first, is that right? And then he was experimented on in a lab. He had an entire life of just tragedies and horror stories and so, things that would destroy your spirit so utterly. And now here he is and he's witnessing another one. And he's done. He's willing to do whatever, damn the consequences.
You mentioned a couple of things there. Alton was captured. He was captured alongside a bunch of other Spearlies. He witnessed the destruction of Spear. He was with several others in basically an internment camp, and he was taken and tortured and experimented on by the Muganese, trying to figure out what gave the Spearly their power. They gave him drugs. It's the reason he's hooked on opium, largely. I guess what I'm asking is, do you think he's desperate to save Nikara, or he's desperate to kill the Muganese? Because it seems to me that what Chagan is saying, he mentions that this is not Spear, that you are going to burn Nikon to the ground. So do you think Alton really cares what happens to the Nikara? I mean, obviously he doesn't want to see the things he's seen today.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that his motivation pretty much the entire book, actually, is not one of patriotism and duty to his state, but one of, I'm going to get to kill a bunch of Muganese.
And we also find out during this discussion, Alton and Chagan have an argument. Alton leaves. Rin comes out and confronts Chagan and wants to know what it was all about. And Chagan gives Rin the backstory. Tells him that by the time the Hesperians had liberated the facilities, Alton had spent half his life in a lab. He had been tortured, he had been drugged, and he was the only one that survived. The average Spearly was not half so strong with the Phoenix as Alton is. And the reason Alton is so strong is because he has the hatred of an entire race within him. He's seeking vengeance, not just for himself, but for every Spearly. And the Phoenix is feeding on that. And it is driving him mad. I'll say one other thing. I think deep down, Chagan is afraid that Alton has a point. I think Chagan is afraid that Nikon might be lost if the Empress is betraying them. If the Nikon army is in such shambles, they've already lost their war capital. Maybe all they can do is take the Mugen down with them. When Rin finds Alton. He's back in the library, back with his opium pipe. And this time, Rin joins him. And she tells him that she wants to help him with his plan. She understands him now. And she's ready to embrace the Phoenix. She's ready to embrace whatever horrible power she needs to end the threat. And so the two journey to Chulukorik. And Chagan and Kara go on a mission to destroy a dam in the north. Very similar to Rin's hypothetical tactics question. They're going to blow up a dam that's going to cut off the Muganese advance from the north. And perhaps drown a good number of them in the lowlands. Do you have any thoughts or insights?
We don't know that until later.
Yeah, but even later, it's not really made explicit what they achieved.
Right. We were talking about that earlier.
Yeah. So I think that was just kind of getting Rin and Alton alone.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that was the point.
I talked about my bodies. Do you want to talk a little bit about what happens once they get to the Chulukorik?
Sure. So the two of them set off to Chulukorik. There is no one along the way. So it's just the two of them the entire journey. Alton had actually been there before. He had helped, I don't remember his name, the previous commander, the guy who has control Tyr. Over shadows. Tyr, that's right. Alton had helped Tyr subdue the commander before him, drag him here, and imprison him. And so he knows the way. It should also be mentioned that Alton told the Empress of his plan, and she had approved of it. So the two...
Wait a second. Let me interrupt you there.
Sure.
Why do you do that?
Well, they didn't know that she betrayed them.
I think
not the smartest idea on Alton's part.
I forgot he did that.
Yeah, that's how they know.
Yeah, why did he do that? That they knew somebody had betrayed him. They knew that the Empress fled the capital.
Yeah, I knew immediately it was her. Even without the previous chapter where she betrayed Tyr, I was like, well, that's obvious. Someone you love has betrayed you.
Well, I guess none of them really love anyone, so...
Except for Alton and Chagan.
That's true. Chagan at least. I think Chagan was more committed to that relationship.
Yeah. I can't see Alton loving it.
I am, like, Chagan can, you know what, he'll love again. He's going to get through it. I like Chagan so much, and I just want him to be happy. I want someone in this book to be happy.
I don't see how anyone will end up happy at the end of this.
No one will ever be happy again. Yeah. Okay, all right. I'm sorry.
So, yeah, Alton sends a message to the Empress and gets this plan approved. And he and Rin get to the Chulukorik, and they go inside. And inside, they have there's like a list of everyone who's imprisoned there. And wouldn't you know, at the very top or bottom of that list, the most recent prisoner is Master Jean, who has not been seen since he opened up a portal for a bunch of crazy monsters to come through in the Battle of Sinegard. So they open up his cell first, and Jean does not want to join them. He basically tells them that they shouldn't be doing what they're trying to do. And Rin says that Nikara will be completely wiped out, and he says, well, just let it happen.
So I have a number of highlights from this chapter. This is possibly the most highlighted chapter in the book for me. Just a couple of a couple of highlights from Zhang's counter arguments. Zhang looked pained. It's easy to be brave, harder to know when not to fight. I've learned that lesson. I want to save Nikon, Alton insisted. He repeated in a strained voice as if trying to convince himself. I want to save Nikon. No, you don't, Zhang said. You want to raise Mugen. They're the same thing. There is a world of difference between them, and the fact that you don't see that is why you can't do this. And I think that really, like, that quote specifically really sums up the crux of the argument. That, you know, a key morality piece here. The part three, the main argument seems to be, is it better to be destroyed or to become a destroyer? What do you think? Are you on Zhang's side or are you on Rin and Alton's side?
Yeah, that's a complex question.
Well, and
especially because they dive into it a lot more, both the end of the book and the history of Spear wrestle with that question.
I would argue that it's probably the key theme. It becomes the key theme of the book, I think.
It's been argued and discussed, I mean, ever since, well, it's relevant to say the atomic bombs, okay? Ever since those bombs were dropped in 45, it has been discussed to death, back and forth, whether it was justified or not, and there's really no right or wrong answer.
No, and that's why I say it's a morality question, because it like you said, it's a complicated question with no correct answer. It's really a question of survival. Like if you are never going to take the role of the destroyer and maintain that moral high ground, you're not going to be around very long, and all that's going to be left are the destroyers. And so there's the answer is, you know, some combination of the two. You have to decide what's worth going all out for and when to hold back. And I think that's what Zhang's saying is it's easy to be brave, harder to know when not to fight. And I think Zhang is saying, you know, fight your human wars with human weapons. But these forces, if you're going to bring them into it, that's the line you can't cross.
And that's been an argument for a while, too, that the atomic bombs were so devastating that they are objectively a different form of warfare than what came before.
Yeah. And the argument concludes with Zhang telling Alton that he failed Alton. He should have tried harder to help Alton, and now Alton's just beyond repair.
And he does try to convince Rin, though. He doesn't think she's beyond.
I was going to say one more thing about Alton.
Ah.
Zhang also reveals that Alton's manipulation and abuse didn't stop when he was freed from Spear. The Empress in the school continued to supply Alton with opium as a means of controlling him through his addiction. They took him away from Zhang because they knew Zhang was going to try to turn him off the path of becoming their weapon. And Zhang should have tried harder to save Alton. But yes, like you said, he tells Alton that while it's too late for him, Rin doesn't have to go down this path. He doesn't want Alton to burn her along with himself. And they both look at Rin. I want to read another quote. Rin glanced between them. So this was her choice. The path before her was clear. Alton or Zhang. Commander or master. Victory and revenge. Or whatever Zhang had promised her. But what had he promised her? Only wisdom. Only understanding. Enlightenment. but those meant only further warnings, petty excuses to hold her back from exercising a power that she knew she could access. You could probably guess the variety of problems I have with that thought. I actually have a quote. I have a note next to that in my book. I was like, can you imagine, for a moment, to put it in our Western context, Jesus himself comes down and says, put down your sword. I am your salvation. And you're like, wait, but I have to give up my sword? Oh, it bothers me so much. Oh, it bothers me so much. So I don't know if that, you know, obviously Rin can't turn back at this point, but it's...
There weren't a lot of good arguments in favor of Zhang at this point.
It bothers me, like, for Rin to want to destroy the Muganese, for her to have anger and rage is totally justified at this point. And for that anger and rage to be blinding is also totally justified at this point, given what she has been through. But just the fact that she can consciously acknowledge only wisdom, understanding, enlightenment, salvation, you know, only things that humanity as a whole has been seeking since their creation. But that would hold me back from accessing my power. And it's like right out of like being a bad guy for dummies. I'm gonna throw away all the good in favor of my power for, and it almost seems like she's doing it for power's sake.
Are you trying to say that Anakin Skywalker had a better motivation than Rin did?
Why? Why you gotta make it like that? Did you ever see Avatar: The Last Airbender?
Yeah, I watched all of it.
Okay. So, right before Aang is about to confront the Fire Lord, and he's having all the conversations with the previous Avatars. So, for anyone who hasn't seen it, the main character Aang comes from a nonviolent Buddhist tradition. He's a vegetarian. He believes life is sacred, and he believes in preserving it to the fullest extent possible. But he's up against an enemy who has no qualms about killing and is about to commit a genocide. And Aang is searching for a way to deal with this situation without using his overwhelming power to kill this man. And every person he speaks with tells him, yes, what you're thinking about withdrawing from the world, about being a pacifist, these are the ways to enlightenment, but you need to sacrifice your own salvation, your own enlightenment, for the sake of the world. You need to kill this guy. And so that is kind of the discussion that makes sense to me here. If Rin had wanted to say, I could have these things, I could have this wisdom, this enlightenment, I could live in peace, but can I live with what happens if I don't use my power? Can I live with the total destruction of the Nikaran people when I could stop it? I get that, and maybe that's what was trying to come out here, but all I hear is Rin saying, they are petty excuses to hold her back from exercising a power that she knows she can access. So I guess she doesn't say my power, a power she knows she can use. So I guess she knows she has the ability, and she's angry, and it came off to me as self-centered, as be like the same problem I have with Alton's motivations. Their actions make sense. Their motivations, in my opinion, at least Alton's, are misguided. Alton's understandable. He's tortured. He's on drugs. He isn't in his right mind. He's not thinking clearly. And God damn it, he has his reasons for being that way. I get it. Rin it's like Xiong said, like, you know, you're at a crossroads here, and you're just, to me, she's just charging headlong without much of a second thought. And it doesn't jive for me with what she said about seeing Alton smoking opium and just seeing his dopey face in the midst of all this carnage, that he took himself to a place where he can no longer feel the immense pain around him. And that being the saddest thing of all, how does that person also see things like wisdom, understanding, and enlightenment as petty excuses to keep her from accessing power? Maybe that's the evidence of it being a good book, is it frustrates me in that way. Did you fall asleep?
She picks Alton. I don't think it was ever in debate that she would choose otherwise.
I guess she should feel a little bad about it. That's my thing.
It's weird because she does feel bad about it later. And at that point, I was just like, why do you feel bad about it now?
Because probably for the first, like, she took 5 seconds to think about it. But do you have any thoughts? You just want to move on?
Yeah, I think we've covered it pretty well.
All right. Zhang seals himself back up and refuses to speak to them anymore if this is the path they're going down. And why don't you tell me what happens next?
So they decide to try the next cell down, which Alton recognizes as the commander before Tyr. So they unseal him, and he has an almost skeletal appearance because he's been there and his body has decayed without, you know, food and water. And I think at that moment, just seeing him, Rin realized it's probably not going to work, because the further back you go, the more frail and broken the body will be anyway. But they think maybe this could work because Alton knows this guy. Maybe he can calm him down, and maybe he can keep the man in charge rather than the god.
I think Rin immediately doubts that that's going to happen. And it's not just because of his decayed state, but the way he's speaking.
Yeah,
he refers to him,
in his right mind.
No, he refers to himself as we. He insists that the personality of the human is gone.
He does briefly. He either comes back or he pretends to. And he tells Alton that he should kill himself before the god takes over. And with that, he attempts to push Alton to his death. At the very least, as a distraction, Rin will be forced to save Alton, and while she's doing that, he runs up the stairs, out the door, so that he can gain his power once again.
You know what's funny?
That he got out, even though a bunch of Mugenese were right outside the door?
Yeah. Yeah, that's another thing. Yeah. I didn't think about until we're going through it again. like, oh shit, he got away. And then they run out after him, and they just run smack into an army.
Yeah, why did they let him go?
Probably because dude was like conjuring a bunch of wind and flying around, and they were like, oh, that's not what I was paid to do today. That's not my mission. So.
Yeah, Rin saves Alton, and I guess the minute or so of head start was all the Mugenese needed to get into place.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's just say, like, it's a plot hole.
Yeah.
It was like the Phelan thing was cool. Phelan being the guy who was the wind spirit. It was a cool scene when he got out, but when Alton and Rin leave through the same exit moments later, they are ambushed by the Mugen army.
Like the whole army.
There's a
sizable chunk.
Yeah, and being unable to use their powers within the mountain, it is the perfect place to trap a shaman, which they very easily do. Rin and Alton are taken prisoner. Rin's knocked unconscious. When she wakes up, she finds herself in a covered wagon. She's looking around, trying to find any way where she could see maybe where they are. She looks outside, doesn't recognize the area. She's trying to get loose from her ropes, and Alton gives her the shh. I got this. And he conjures a little flame, and he starts burning through the rope. That pretty immediately fills the covered wagon with smoke, which seems like obvious. And smelling the smoke, the Mugen soldiers quickly throw the cover off the wagon, and Alton bursts into his full phoenix form, and they what do they do, Nate?
What do they do to this man who can burn flesh and burn armor? They throw a bucket of water on him.
The old bucket of water. You know what? You know how Rin, channeling the phoenix for the first time, not being as strong as Alton, you know how Rin melted a dude in his armor and then melted the armor? That guy didn't have a bucket of water. There's this whole thing about Mugen people. I think when they're interrogating one of the prisoners, one of the Mugen says, like, "Oh, you're a Spearly. We know how to deal with Spearlies." They do. It's a bucket of water. Give it a few more years, they'll have invented the hose. Maybe a super soaker, and then spear was on its way out anyway. Ironic that they were on an island surrounded by water. Not only does it put out the flames, it like physically hurts him. Like when his phoenix fire is put out, that causes him physical pain. I'm gonna go ahead and say that's two plot holes, because that was dumb. I'm gonna take an aggressive stance and say that was a dumb thing to add to a 500 page book. They should have just woken up at their destination.
I agree, absolutely.
That was so dumb. Oh God, why do you think she did that? Like, we pretend to be writers. I would, like, okay, if anyone doesn't know, we occasionally take turns writing, and we've been writing partners for a few years now, and I'll write something, Nate'll edit it, and when Nate writes something, I edit it for him, and I feel like I have told you to get rid of scenes that made way more sense than that, because it was like, oh no, that kind of counteracts like what you're going for.
Right. Or, oh, this part makes him look too weak and pathetic.
Yeah. Previous chapter, dude says, the average Spearly wasn't half as powerful as Alton. Smash cut to bucket of water. If this ever becomes a movie, and I'm sure it will, you could do such a, like, I hope they leave that scene in so that you could do a compilation of people saying how crazy powerful the Spearlies are. Bucket of water. Bucket of water. I will say, it was much needed comic relief. I was really bummed out reading this book, and then that helped. Need a little, like, goddamn, like the Three Stooges could have beat Spear. All right.
Goddamn.
Yeah.
All right. Do you want to talk about the lab?
All right. So the next time Rin and Alton awaken, they are strapped to a table. They awaken to find that they are with a bizarre Mugen doctor in a lab. And the lab is filled with preserved organs and other human remains. It's another horror show. This guy is a bizarre, like, Joseph Mengele-style doctor performing human experiments, using the quote-unquote lesser race as his research material. And he announces that he is so happy that Alton could join them again. And this is the guy who was responsible for torturing and drugging Alton over all those years, and now he finally has Alton back, and he's so happy that he has another Spearley back with him as well, because he thought Alton was the only one, but now this will really help them figure out what gives the Spearley their power. And he's very, very polite and very creepy. Very much reminded me of the one Nazi guy from Indiana Jones.
So, yeah, they're both strapped to tables when they come to. And he does give Alton heroin right away, but he does not give Rin heroin. He does mention during this sequence that the Empress betrayed them. And that's how they knew where to find them at the Chulu Kore.
What? She did.
He mentions that.
She did that?
Yeah.
She betrayed
them? I know,
them?
Right? Who would have thought?
Oh my god. Wow. Wow. This is a tough day.
So, what they did with Rin is, after they gave heroin to Alton, they put chloroform over her and she passed out.
Can I ask you a question as a medical professional?
Sure.
What kind of equipment or process do you need to turn opium into heroin?
Yes, as a medical professional, I do this all the time. I think we both had a lot of problems with this lab existing.
It's clearly a World War II laboratory, but can I tell you, the thing that maybe bothered me the most was that they called it heroin.
Really?
Yeah.
That's what bothered you the most. Well, what took me out of the atmosphere was weaponized play. The laboratory director, he specifically mentions that they are creating a plague and weaponizing it. And to be clear, this isn't like the medieval form of spreading disease where you throw corpses over the walls. This is actually discovering germs and isolating the bacteria responsible for plague and then reproducing that bacteria and then finding a way to weaponize it for the express purpose of killing all of the Nakari.
It's pretty bad when you put it like that, but I still think mine's worse. A problem for me is more generally a question of atmosphere. I think everybody's going to have their attention drawn to a different thing based on their own backgrounds and knowledge, but there's enough from the modern world brought into a medieval setting that you're going to notice it's just clashing a little bit. It's just a little bit dissonant. And maybe it's the germ theory part, maybe it's the urban warfare part, maybe it's they don't have guns but they do have cannons, and you know, there's so much going on that is from dissonant periods of history that it doesn't gel together to create a convincing fantasy atmosphere. Or when it does gel together to create a convincing fantasy atmosphere, something always comes in and interrupts it and takes you out of it. And it's like, oh, I'm back in World War II. I'm either in medieval China or I'm in World War II, but they don't ever feel like they're the same place.
Yeah, I can agree with that. They attempt to escape again. They get hit with another bucket of water. And then Alton gets hit with another dose of heroin.
I forgot they got hit with another bucket of water. Should have just poured a bucket of heroin on him.
That would have been better. And this time, they do get Rin with the heroin.
You make it sound like they're shooting heroin at them, like with some kind of dart gun.
That would have been nice. But then I would have to say, why don't you have guns that fire bullets? So, anyway.
And they'd have been like, the fuck's a bullet?
The head scientist seemed to not want them to hit Rin with the heroin. But they did, and she and Alton travel to the Pantheon together, and from there, Alton is able to show Rin the history of the Spearley people, where they had basically been used for their entire existence. The Spearley queen who keeps stopping Rin from accessing the Phoenix, she had the choice of either tapping into the power and wiping out the Nakarans, or submitting and basically making her people into slaves. And she finally understands her people, her heritage, and the anger and sorrow that comes with them.
And I think she has a conversation with the Spearleys, doesn't she?
I think she just sees their sorrow. I think that there are a bunch of Spearleys on the island, and they're all just... they've got long faces, and I don't think she actually talks to any of them other than Alton.
You might be right. I might be confusing a different scene.
She and Alton come back down. She is able to unleash the Phoenix, and together they melt the director and make their escape. There were no buckets of water this time.
There was a crossbow. They did pick it up just in case. They might need a crossbow to do something fireballs couldn't.
Alton tells Rin to go to the island. The laboratory is on Nakara, and it is on the coast. And it's as close to Spear as you can be on the Nakaran mainland. So he tells her to swim there while he holds them off, and he ends up basically doing a suicide charge on them and taking himself out, as well as all the Muganese.
She heads to the island, and she steps onto the beach. The beach is just strewn with human bones. The whole place is pretty much like bombed out, human remains everywhere. She goes to the Temple of the Phoenix. Temple of the Phoenix is totally burnt down, but she finds a trapdoor, and a large portion of the temple is actually underground and untouched. And that's where the altar to the Phoenix actually is. So the Nakaran and Mugen didn't get it when they destroyed the island.
Okay. The temple itself looks like the Pantheon, but there's only the one god there. There's only the Phoenix. Rin goes to the Pantheon in this temple. She once again meets the Spear Queen, who tries to talk her out of this. And she... Rin dresses her down, and you failed your people, and get the fuck out of my gym. I mean, my temple.
Yeah. I guess Rin was from Spear. We don't know how she got to Nakara, right?
Like, or how nobody knew that she was a Spearly.
So, the weird thing about Rin being like, I'm just going to one more place in the book where I don't know if it's intentional or not intentional, but it's a good place where the cycle of violence is really illustrated, as Rin is telling this lady, you failed your people, you should have taken this deal, you should have destroyed Nakara. Wait a minute. You know? Like, think about it. Now you're sitting here, like if she should have done that, just don't do anything. It'll be destroyed soon.
So yeah, Rin tells her to hit the bricks.
Fuck up my gym.
And she then talks with the Phoenix.
Jane
the
Gray.
Phoenix asks what she wants, and she presumes that the Phoenix also wants what she wants, which is the destruction of Mugen. And the Phoenix tells her that it doesn't have any ambition. It gives what it is asked of it.
What I want, the Phoenix sounded amused. The gods do not want anything. The gods merely exist. We cannot help what we are. We are pure essence, pure element. You humans inflict everything on yourselves and then blame us afterward. Every calamity has been man-made. We do not force you to do anything. We have only ever helped. This is my destiny, Rin said with conviction. I am the last Spearly. I have to do this. It is written. Nothing is written, said the Phoenix. I'm not going to read the whole book.
That's good. That's good.
I'm augmenting what you're saying.
So the Phoenix mentions that Alton got what he wanted, which was death.
Phoenix. The Phoenix has, like, maybe not the best resume for customer satisfaction.
Yeah, Alton wanted to die heroically. He wanted to go out in a blaze of glory, and that's exactly what he got. And it asks what Rin wants. Rin wants the destruction of Mugen.
So I do want to read one more thing from the Phoenix. The gods choose nothing. You choose. You chose to take the exam. You chose to come to Signguard. You chose to pledge lore. You chose to study the paths of the gods. And you chose to follow your commander's demands over your master's warnings. At every critical juncture, you were given an option. You were given a way out. Yet you picked precisely the roads that led you here. You are at this temple, kneeling before me, only because you wanted to be. And you know that should you give the command, I will call something terrible. I will wreak a disaster to destroy the island of Mugen completely, as thoroughly as Spear was destroyed. By your choice, many will die. I think that really hammers home that Rin, like, isn't a victim of circumstance. You know, when I've been saying it frustrates me that Rin has this odd motivation, it's almost like the Phoenix is telling Rin at the very end, it's like, just admit you're an angry girl who wants to kill a bunch of people.
Yeah. She's like, all right, I'm an angry girl and I want to kill people. Let's do it. And they high five so hard that a volcano erupts.
But the Phoenix does ask what Rin can give her in return for being granted this power.
These nuts.
Yeah, and surprisingly, that works. And yeah, Rin drops just the sickest album. And she becomes a SoundCloud rapper. Now, Rin promises to give worship and an unending flow of blood in return for the Phoenix's help. The ghost of the Spearly Queen begs her not to do this, and Rin says, do it. So Rin orders the Phoenix to destroy Mugen, and she erupts in a column of fire. The fire filled the temple, gushed out the doors and into the night, where many miles away, Federation children lay sleeping in their beds. The whole world was on fire. She had not just altered the fabric of the universe, had not simply rewritten the script. She had torn it apart, ripped a gaping hole in the cloth of reality, and set fire to it with the ravenous rage of an uncontrollable god. Once the fabric had contained the stories of millions of lives, the lives of every man, woman, and child on the Longbow Island, civilians who had gone to bed easy, knowing what their soldiers did across the narrow sea was a far-off dream, fulfilling the promise of their emperor, of some great destiny they had been conditioned to believe in ever since birth. In an instant, the script had written their stories to the end. At one point in time, those people existed, and then they didn't. Because nothing was written. The Phoenix had told Rin that. The Phoenix had shown Rin that. And so, yeah, Rin scorches Mugen to the ground and burns everyone alive. Those who are not instantly killed die of suffocation as the smoke fills the atmosphere. And, yeah, basically the entire island is no man's land. They can't even get close to it for all the fires that are raging. When Rin awakens from her awful dream where she feels the death of every man, woman, and child on the island, she is on a boat with her friends around her.
What a happy ending. She's just on a boat with all of her friends. The war is over.
I mean, that's not untrue.
Yeah, so they're on a boat. Kite is on the boat. The 13th Division is on the boat. Kite informs her of what she did and notes that Rin's eyes are now red, just like Alton's and just like other Spearleys. He doesn't see her as the same person anymore. He's kind of avoiding her. He realizes that she committed a horrific atrocity. She's kind of upset at him because he's judging her, even though they both saw what happened in the Capitol.
Kite, at first, is trying to commiserate with her. He hears the story of her calling the god and burning the island of Mugen to the ground, and he says, oh no, your god, it made you do this. And she says that the god didn't make her do anything, and she chose it. She doesn't regret it. And Kite is horrified by that, that she just killed thousands of innocent people. And Rin becomes very defensive. They tortured her. They killed Alton. You saw what they did. And she, you know, pretty bluntly says they got what they deserved. Kite just can't believe what he's hearing. He can't believe that she thinks anyone could deserve that. And Rin is equally dumbfounded that he can think that no one deserves that. Didn't he see what they did to Golan Nis? And Kite said that what you did became the monster you were trying to fight. And that's again going back to that theme of destroy or be destroyed, which is better. This is the crux of the book, and this is, I think, what makes it a really interesting and unique addition to fantasy. Because fantasy is always, a lot of it's derivative of Lord of the Rings, which you could argue is derivative of, like, the Once and Future King or the King Arthur legends, where it's about good versus capital E evil, evil that comes from outside, not from within the hearts of people. Or as this final conversation between Rin and Kite is really the argument that the author wants you to have with yourself. In a lot of ways, it's a discussion that doesn't often come up in fantasy, specifically with the hero. Like, what Rin is doing is not objectively right or wrong. And I know we, outside of preparing for the podcast, we talked about the morality of what Rin did and if Rin was justified, or it really caused a lot of debate. And it's also not a one-to-one allegory in this case of what actually happened in real life, but the author has made no attempt to hide the fact that these events are inspired by real life events. They are real questions that we have to ask ourselves. You mentioned the atomic bomb. We've talked about World War II and the Holocaust and the fact that these awful, unforgivable things happen. And then we all have to keep living in the same world with each other. And how do you do that? You know, what is justified in war and what isn't justified in war? And
yeah. All right. I think I have the answer.
Oh, boy.
I have the answer. Okay.
Okay.
Do you want to be the destroyed or the destroyers? All right. You want to be the destroyers, but not the ones that actually make the decision. You just want to be in a position to benefit. And then you can just feel bad about it later, I guess, or pretend to.
I mean, that's an American philosophy, if there was one. Would you agree with what I'm saying, though, that Kite and Rin are having a somewhat meta conversation here?
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I think there's, like, this conversation, the conversation between Zhang, Rin, and Alton, and even the conversation between Rin and the Phoenix. These are, they make sense in the book, but they're also meta commentaries on the themes of the book. And those are probably some of my favorite conversations in the book. Just to sort of wrap up the summary, Rin, despite what she says to Kite, feels a tremendous amount of guilt. She does have a hard time living with what she does, and she asks for opium. She begins doing what Alton did to live with the horrors of war. She begins smoking opium. And the book ends with a funeral for Alton, where Chagan is extremely upset, and he argues with Rin a bit. And this is where I'm basing my fan theory that Chagan and Alton may have been more than friends. That Chagan was obviously very, at the very least, if they weren't romantically involved, Chagan had a tremendous amount of respect and admiration for Alton, even more than any of the other members of the 13th. But yeah, the book ends, I don't want to say on a cliffhanger, but it ends with Rin in a deep depression, the 13th somewhat leaderless, and Kite not speaking with her.
Well, you forget, they also mention that they have to do something about the Wend demigod.
Yeah. And
she also vows to bring down the Empress.
That'll be the start of the next book. She needs to establish a new government in Nikara. And I don't know, to me, the Wind deity almost seems like a side quest. Like,
yeah, it didn't seem that important to me, but they needed stuff to do.
If she can destroy whole islands from 100 miles away, I don't know what this dude's going to do to her. The challenges of setting up a replacement government are probably more interesting than any physical challenge she could ever engage with, because she's, I just can't imagine anyone can physically challenge Rin anymore.
Are you interested in reading the sequel to this?
I'm 100% going to read the sequel for this. I know we haven't decided yet if we want to cover the rest of the series on the podcast, but I'll say the book had a pretty profound effect on me. There are parts I like, parts I don't like. We've talked about the dissonance between the two time periods that the book draws from. We've also talked a little bit about the problems of close allegory, like transparent allegory. So those are issues I have, but I need to know for myself where this is going. I think the author, R.F. Kuang, has a lot of interesting perspective and interesting things to say about history and philosophy. And I really want to know what the moral of the story is going to be, if there is a moral to the story, if Rin is going to slowly learn that Zhang was right about a lot of things. I'm interested to hear more about the magic system, not so much because I care about the magic system per se, but because I really want to know where they're going with the gods, and if the gods can be a positive influence on humanity as opposed to just this purely destructive force. So I'm definitely going to read the next book. For some of the problems I have with the writing, I'd say this book was super interesting nonetheless. So what are your thoughts? I know you don't enjoy stone cold bummers as much as I do. So
I mean, I do like BoJack Horseman, but
that is a stone cold bummer.
little different though.
So you're saying what you'd really like is a cartoon horse to help you get through it?
Yes, I would like a cartoon horse giving one-liners in between the bummers.
If the Phoenix could just be voiced by Will Arnett, that would help.
That actually would help. if we can get that to happen, I'm all on board. You know, the more we talked about it, the more I think, yeah, I'll probably read the second book. I don't know if we'll do it for the podcast or not. Knowing us, probably, since we got so much material out of the first book. My only concern was I felt like it had peaked, and it's going to take a lot to prove me wrong that this is the peak and it's all downhill from here.
So simultaneously, I feel like it has peaked. It's going to be tough to top the emotional lows of this book, for sure. If part two lagged, part three raced. The chapters written about Golan Nis were really powerful. not just because they were drawn from real life events. Quang really put a lot of emotion into that, and I imagine it was a lot harder to write than it was to read. And so, yeah, I do agree that I don't know how you top what you did here. At the same time, this is not finished. This is not a satisfying conclusion. The Mugenese are the big bad guys, but really, Rin has only spoken to a handful of Mugenese people, and she wiped out an entire civilization, and there's got to be consequences to that. And we can argue about whether it's right or wrong or not, but the fact that the author specifically goes on to say, as it's happening, that there were just thousands of stories that ended when Rin did this. The fact that Nikara itself is in such a mess. The fact that Nikara, or Nikon, conquered Spear, and that Spear was given the same choice about whether or not to stop the Nikarans, and they didn't. Zhang's teaching, and who Zhang is, and the spiritual nature of shamanism. There's just so much that we didn't get a chance to explore in this book that, yeah, I don't know if it's going to be as emotionally impactful as the Poppy War. I think the next one's the Dragon Emperor.
It's actually called the Dragon Republic, and that came out last year.
Yeah, so I don't know if they can replicate the emotional lows of this book, but I really don't see this ending well for Rin. I don't see Rin coming out of this happy, fulfilled person. There's just a lot of the world left to explore, and I'm totally fascinated by Quang's perspective. And I, like, what I think I really want to do is I really want to have a conversation with R.F. Quang. But what I will settle for is finding out what she thinks through her books. I think it's a really fascinating perspective.
All right, I think that's about it for final thoughts. We have talked at length. We've gone over this book in great detail. I think that we've said all we can possibly say about this. Next episode, we're going to be reading Make Love, The Bruce Campbell Way, by Bruce Campbell. So that'll be interesting. Check that out. We'll see you next time. What was the guy's name? I keep wanting to call him Chungus.
I think that part needs to be like the little outro piece.